You're listening to The Impromptu on the Hologram Radio Network, a multifaceted show discussing how technology, art, design, and equality converge on topics that matter most to us. From gaming culture to film and other forms of media, we examine the creative process and how the decisions we make shape our perceptions and lives. This is Alex Knight, and I am joined by Michael Norton. Episode 69, Augmented Reality and Policy. Today on the program, Michael and I got into a very thought-provoking conversation about virtual reality and where it's going and a future society that relies on augmented reality in their daily lives. And what are the perils of a society that adopts something like that? What kind of privacy issues are there? Does the government need to step in and create policy to regulate that industry to protect people from all of the different issues that can arise? But before we get to the meat of the discussion with VR and augmented reality, Michael and I started this episode off with a little chat about CES and rumored 8K iMac Pro models, which is a thing apparently. And now the show.
There's a new version of HDMI that supports 8K with HDR that is going to be important at some point in the somewhat distant future. I don't know. Like, we're barely on 4K now.
And on that note, I heard people talking about a rumor of an 8K iMac Pro, which supposedly would replace the Mac Pro. I don't buy that.
People just want to leap to the next thing, but you can't just do that all the time. And in fact, most of the time, you can't just leap to the next thing. I mean, like I said, we're barely transitioned to 4K as it is. Now you want to go to 8K? Where's your content for that? Nowhere. I mean, sure, some movies are shot in 8K, so there is, like, technically source material out there that could feasibly run on a screen like that. And other than that, the first 8K footage won't really be until the Tokyo Olympics in 2020, when they want to shoot all of the events with 8K cameras.
Why go to 8K? What does that get us?
It doesn't really get us anything. I mean, 4K is already Retina for the most part. 8K just goes even further. Like, I would say 8K is probably the hard limit. Like, past 8K, you're just going to get diminishing returns where no one is going to go, wow, that looks so much better than 8K, because it won't.
Right.
And I mean, Apple figured this out fairly early on, and it's why iPhones haven't really jumped up in pixel density, because you suffer diminishing returns. The human eye just, like, past a certain point, the human eye can no longer discern any pixels. They can't discern more of the pixels. The image just looks perfect. And you can keep adding pixels, but it's still going to look the same to the human eye. It won't matter ultimately.
It's just silly because I look at 4K and I don't even have a 4K TV, but every time I see a demo of it, that to me looks so unbelievable, like almost too much detail. Mm-hmm. And so I can't even imagine anything more than that.
Yeah. It's like, I could see if you wanted to have like a 150-inch or 200-inch TV, then 8K might look reasonable. But for most people with a regular-sized living room, 4K is going to be good enough. So, yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's probably the latest thing that people that go to CES think is going to be the next thing. I don't know. There's always something at CES where it's like, yeah, this is going to be the next thing for sure, and then it isn't. I mean, I have no doubt we'll eventually transition to 8K in certain use cases. Like computer monitors, it makes perfect sense to have an 8K monitor because then you can watch two 4K videos at the same time, or have a 4K video running while you have a whole other 4K amount of pixels to play with.
That requires a lot more GPU to process that, doesn't it?
Yes.
And
yes,
we're already having problems with 4K. Like, we're just getting around now to producing GPUs that can run that smoothly.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it depends what you're using it for. Gaming, obviously, we're going to need a graphics card twice as fast as the current flagship to run 8K. And that's just to run it. To run it well, probably have to go further than that. But for basic purposes, current cards could probably run an 8K display. Like, you can you'd totally be able to run like Excel and Word and
Those Chrome are not intensive apps. But I've always wondered, like, I don't know, I used to be so on top of this GPU stuff, but I haven't really followed it in a long time. But I assume that they're multi-core, multi-processor even. At least on a desktop, like a desktop GPU, I would imagine has,
I think,
multi-core at least.
Technically it does. It has compute units.
Because I've always wondered how it... When you load up a game, there's the actual... Like, it needs to drive... The CPU on the GPU needs to do, or the GPU, I guess, needs to drive and render all the pixels on the, like, power the display, and then there's the actual rendering of what's in the pipeline from the game.
Well, that's what gets output to the screen. So the GPU renders everything.
Or it's
and
just
then,
doing it all at once.
Yes.
Okay.
Like, I mean, to the human eye, it's all happening instantaneously, but essentially the compiled code of the game runs through the GPU, through the render pipeline. Each frame is rendered and then spit out to the monitor.
Got it. Okay.
So this is all happening insanely fast, of course, because if you're playing a game at ultra, running at 60 frames a second, the GPU is running through so many renders so quickly. But if you slowed it down, obviously, yeah, it's drawing polygons, it's drawing particle effects, it's calculating physics, it's doing a bunch of stuff every millisecond. And the way that they've kind of optimized for that is, instead of using cores, at least NVIDIA has architected a chip that has many, many compute units. And each compute unit is tasked with various parts of the render pipeline. So that allows them to parallelize the entire rendering chain so that they can basically deliver everything that needs to be displayed on the screen for a frame just in time. So the code goes in one end, filters through all of the compute units, and then comes out the other side as a rendered frame. And that allows the render time to be cut down dramatically, which is, of course, is what allows games to run at 30 and then 60 and then for VR 120 and higher.
And 60 frame rates is the kind of holy grail what we want our games to be actually running at, right?
Ideally, yes. For a game running on a monitor, yeah, you'd want 60 frames a second for
it to be perfectly smooth. Even on a TV too, right?
Yeah.
At 1080p.
Yeah. TV, game computer monitor, what have you. VR is a different story because VR is essentially replacing your vision. The human eye and the human nervous system react very badly to poor frame rates in that kind of situation. So to prevent severe motion sickness, VR essentially has to start at 120 frames a second. Otherwise, it is so jarring to the brain that even if you don't become violently ill, you will be disoriented.
And I imagine that's what a lot of people's fears are, probably preconceived notions, maybe from poor, older VR implementations where they just couldn't handle that frame rate. So
people
were actually getting sick.
Yeah, they were. The Virtual Boy was famous for that. In no small part because they had that god-awful red and black display image.
I mean, well, that was a joke because that was 25 years ago, yeah, of course. The hardware wasn't there.
So, yeah, I mean, now it's a lot further along. Now they're actually hitting those frame rates. As for the GPU wars, I would say NVIDIA at this point has basically won. Though, to their credit, AMD are about to release their next generation chipset, Radeon Vega. And they've shown a brief demo clip of a Vega GPU running Doom on 4K at Ultra, and it was consistently hitting 70 frames a second.
The new Doom, the one that came out recently.
The new one.
Right.
Now, some would say it's kind of an unfair test because Doom is optimized abnormally well for a PC
game. It is. Carmack Games are always like that, though. He's obsessed with...
Oh, no. I'm not sure he worked on this, actually. I don't think he worked on the new Doom. He might have
not even
actually,
the engine at all, because Carmack always writes the engines.
The engine is totally his, of course.
And that's really, really done well.
But he left to work at Oculus.
Right.
So, I mean, yeah, they might have the engine, but future iterations of the engine obviously won't be his work. Because he left it to go work for Oculus, which led to a really fun lawsuit, but that's another story. I don't actually know if there's been a determination in that case yet.
This is the first time I'm hearing about this. I didn't realize there was a lawsuit involved.
Yeah, so ZeniMax, the company that owns Bethesda and id, they basically sued Oculus, claiming that when they hired Carmack, they gained access to proprietary IP or something to that effect. Even though, to my knowledge, Bethesda hasn't worked on any sort of VR system at all. So, I'm not sure what the overlap there is, but they seem to think they have a case. I'm not sure if it's resolved or not at this point.
That's interesting.
Actually, speaking of Carmack's work at Oculus, one of the first things he did when he started working there... anyone that knows about John Carmack will be like, yeah, of course. He essentially single-handedly got Gear VR to work properly. He optimized the Oculus code so that VR...
Wait, that's Samsung's...
Yes.
Key. Okay.
So he single-handedly optimized the code that allowed VR to run on Samsung Galaxy devices at a stable frame rate.
You make that sound like that was like a Herculean task or something.
Oh, I have no doubt it was, given how shit.
I mean, not to say I don't mean to diminish his work, because it's obviously, this is far from simple stuff.
Oh, yes. Plus, I mean, Android architecture isn't great to begin with, plus the terrible Snapdragon chips.
What did you just say?
We all know this to be true, even Android fans.
Yeah, it's pretty much true.
Yeah. Speaking of which, Qualcomm announced a new Snapdragon chip, the 835.
With 128 cores.
To run Android. Yeah, no, it's an 8-core. It's an 8-core chip.
8 cores.
Yes, but 4 of them are high efficiency and 4 of them are energy efficiency.
Doing the iPhone
cords.
7 thing.
Yeah. I was just about to say, I wonder where they got that idea.
See, I never thought that would catch on.
Yeah.
I really didn't.
Yeah, no. Apple does something and everyone just goes, that's crazy. We'll never do it. We won't copy that at all. Yeah.
Yeah, there are no copycats. It's just pure innovation happening everywhere with design.
Yeah, exactly. No, never mind that Apple is effectively leading the entire mobile CPU space by like 2 or 3 years. Qualcomm wishes they could have chips as good as that. Like,
you know what? The latest... their chips are probably fine. It's the software.
Well, you would think so, but it seems to be the combination. Like in straight up benchmarks, the Qualcomm chips just simply do not match the performance of the iPhone.
But is there any way to actually run those benchmarks and take Android out of the equation in the benchmark? Because there's got to be some latency there.
I mean,
that would affect it. And I don't know what that is.
That probably doesn't help. We've gone over the issues with Android back and forth multiple times.
Sure.
So I mean, that's obviously a crutch, but the thing is they keep making these chips more and more powerful. So you'd think at some point they would start to make headway on it, but continually we find that the Qualcomm chips paired with Android, and like, this is the latest stuff. This is what Qualcomm says. This is the fastest chip we've ever made, blah, blah. Phone running that, like last year example, the OnePlus 3, right? Latest Snapdragon chip, latest version of Android, everything's flawless. It's basically running pure Android, no add-ons, no bullshit. Straight up test against the 6S, it still gets outlapped.
Yeah, I remember that.
The crazy thing is, they've announced this new chip, and I bet the first phone to use that chip will still get outlapped, or it'll just nearly be as fast as the iPhone 6S. And this will be now two generations removed. And three or four Snapdragon chips,
yeah,
that have failed to beat a almost 2-year-old chip.
Oh, I mean, look, we've talked about this before, and that's obviously been the case, and I imagine it will continue to be like that for a while until something dramatically has to change with Android. So, like, I'm not gonna debate that at all. But
yeah.
That's just the reality. It is what it is, right? It is what it is.
Yeah. It's a difficult problem, and it's one that won't get resolved anytime soon. But yeah, the new Snapdragon, I mean, yeah, 8 cores, 4 high efficiency, 4 energy efficient. And apparently they've got this new chip in there that's supposed to handle VR processing. So they're saying that this chip will be really good for Google Daydream.
Is this almost kind of like an equivalent of a motion coprocessor or whatever that you get on the iPhone?
I think so, yes. Something like that. Like an additional...
Something to offload those separate duties.
Yeah, like it's some kind of additional GPU that helps with the output or something.
Now, what's Google Daydream? Have we talked about that before?
No,
maybe
we
refresh
haven't.
My memory. If
so
we
this was Google's new VR experience that they unveiled at Google I/O last year. And Daydream effectively replaces Google Cardboard, which was their initial foray into VR. And Daydream is, probably miles ahead of what Cardboard was.
Well, I always figured Cardboard was kind of a joke, right?
Well, I don't think it was a joke. It works. It's just,
yeah,
it's not as far along as it ought to be.
It's limited.
Yeah. And Daydream takes that to the next level. So it's a lot more like Gear VR. It's basically Google's version of Gear VR. So you have your Daydream compatible phone. Chances are that's a Google Pixel or Pixel XL. And then you have the $100 Daydream headset. And the Daydream headset's covered in this nice fabric material. It's comfy. You just snap the phone in at the front, lock it in place, and put the headset on. And it comes with this little motion controller with, I think, a kind of a circular D-pad on it. And... I mean, I haven't personally tried it yet. I don't know what it's like. I would assume it's comparable to Gear VR, probably. I think when you put it on, you end up in this sort of VR app store that they have. And there are already a bunch of apps that support Daydream, including Netflix. So you can actually pop your Pixel phone into the Daydream headset and watch Netflix as if you were in a movie theater, which is kind of cool. Which is even cooler now that Netflix lets you download stuff to your phone.
Not the entire library, though. It seems
no,
only a select
not everything,
group of them.
But enough stuff that, I mean, all of their original content is available for download.
Well, of course.
So you can just binge the entire first season of Stranger Things.
Yeah. Hey, look, I'm not complaining, but I'm just making a point.
Yeah, I mean, due to copyrights, obviously, yeah. There are some publishers that are probably like, no, we won't let you do that. And then it's up to Netflix to go, come on. Come on. Until they finally relent. Or not. But anyways, so they've got stuff like that. They've got some games. And some other like weird experiences. I think they basically have everything Cardboard had, so that you can watch YouTube videos in VR. You can use Google Earth, Street View, and all that stuff. Not too sure what else they have, but there's definitely more of. There's more of a focus on developer compatibility. They've got the proper APIs and the proper tools, and they've got all this stuff going for them. Cardboard, I think, was more of an experiment, whereas Daydream is like a proper platform for mobile VR, and it definitely looks promising, but it's going to depend on whether developers start building things for it or not. I personally think it'll take off. I mean, you've got Gear VR with Samsung, but the thing is, Samsung's not the whole Android phone industry. I mean, they're a big part of it, but they're not everybody. So I think there's definitely a space for Google to kind of build a more cross-platform for this stuff. And I mean, hopefully down the road, we see some things from Apple as well. But there's no real indication of that just yet, other than idle speculation.
Well,
I mean, they have to be working on it.
Oh, absolutely.
But
like anything, I mean, with Google, the stuff that Google does, they always do these little hobby projects on the side and kind of see where they go.
Yeah.
So although Google may not be going full force on it yet, I imagine at some point, you know, when the landscape, and it is showing signs of that. Years ago, I never thought VR would actually take off, which is interesting because even as recent as 2 years ago, when I started to see that the hardware capabilities were getting there, I still didn't think it was more than just an expensive hobby for some companies to play with. I didn't think consumers would buy into it. And I don't know how well the PlayStation VR is selling, but I imagine probably better than Oculus and some of the other ones, just because it's Sony PlayStation brand.
Well, yeah, but, it's PlayStation. It has the content. I mean,
yeah,
you can't play Batman anywhere else. You can't play
exactly. Those are big,
Battlefront.
Those are big wins on that platform for sure. Having you know, IPs like Batman, but I think it's interesting. And for the first time, I'm starting to like realize like, wow, this is actually becoming a serious thing, and I can really see VR taking over in some shape or form at some point in the future. And Google, I'm sure when Google gets a whiff of the market going in that direction, they'll probably start taking it really seriously.
Yeah. Well, I think Daydream is what that is. Like, I don't think they're ramping up this giant marketing machine around it yet, but Daydream is very clearly a mature answer to mobile VR. They're basically saying, we've created this platform, we've heard your feedback about Cardboard, and we've created this robust platform for you to develop VR on Android. I think they've definitely put themselves in the best possible position with Daydream. Again, obviously, as with anything like this, it's all down to developers to support it. Or not. And yeah, VR, I don't know. I've always been of the opinion that VR will be a part of the ecosystem. I don't think it will be the whole ecosystem. I think it lends itself well to immersive experiences where you kind of fall into some other world and interact with things. So, I mean, those kinds of games for sure. I think we'll still see console titles that are on a TV, almost certainly, because I don't think VR lends itself to every possible game experience. And not only that, but developing for VR is so much more complicated. Plus, we haven't really figured out the ramifications of, like, do we want to allow some sort of room scale VR where you can walk around? And yeah. If so, I mean, we're toying with it now. You've got Vive, which can track you around a room, and Oculus Touch can now track you around a room with the right amount of sensors.
And what about the stuff that Microsoft is working on?
Well, that's AR.
So that's AR. Okay.
You've got HoloLens. I'll get to that in a minute. But I think there's still a lot of questions to be answered. It's like, if we assume that room scale VR is a thing and it will be the only way of interacting with games, how do you craft a game that allows people to walk around a world the size of, say, The Witcher 3, but you're in a single room the size of a living room? Like, how do you program for that? How do you design that?
Not easily.
No, exactly. Like, these are tough questions, and there has been some work done with, like, holographs. Holodeck style.
Wouldn't you need to put them on some kind of treadmill so they can run around in the world, in the virtual world?
That's one option. There are also concepts about using holodeck style trickery to reorient people.
Right.
Trick them into thinking they're walking in a straight line when actually they're walking around the room.
It's probably fairly easy to trick the human eye. To change the perspective and
It can be, but the problem is you have to do very accurate eye tracking for that to work 100% of the time, and we're not quite there yet. So, I mean, maybe that's what we do. Maybe we do the treadmill thing, or we start looking at some sort of immersive sensory feedback sort of thing.
Yeah.
Where you think about walking around and the game responds with some sort of internalized feedback that makes you think you're walking.
I can't imagine the processing power too involved in computing stuff like that.
Oh yeah.
You know, in real time, like how many isolinear chips does that take?
A lot. I talk about that, but that's like 10, 20, 30 years down the road. Who knows? Being able to calculate the kind of feedback that tricks your brain into thinking you're actually walking or actually getting hit with a sword or whatever. Yeah, that's going to take a long time. So I think for the immediate future, we're probably going to be stuck with these sort of half-baked VR solutions that you feel like you're immersed, but it's never quite the way you would want it to be necessarily. I think it's going to take quite a while before we get to total immersion where suddenly you're like in the Matrix or something. That's a ways off. So then to AR, I think AR is probably going to have the larger market share of the overall mixed reality ecosystem. Primarily because it's far easier to insert digital content into reality than it is to create an entire reality around you. Plus, it has so much more applications.
Well, Pokemon, for one thing.
Well,
that's like the first thing absolutely. That'll come out on that.
You have to have Pokemon Go on HoloLens.
Absolutely.
For sure. Or Apple Glasses or whatever Google finally does after burning Google Glass in a furnace. AR, there's just so much more you can do with it. Like, think about every job that requires some sort of technical expertise or having to look at intricate parts or needing to be able to put things together. With AR, you can have each step highlighted. You can have an overlay on certain pieces. You can show detailed data on stuff that you're looking at, and it all just kind of blends seamlessly with what you're actually doing. There's no total illusion there. You're just working with what already exists, which is easier, but at the same time, it's also harder because you have to mesh reality with this content in a way that makes sense and in a way that benefits the user. So I'll do a little plugging here. The company I work for, Finger Food Studios, we've been doing a ton of work in this space. We recently opened a, I'm probably not going to get this exactly right. I think it's around 23,000 square feet. It's a really big warehouse. We actually call it the holodeck, and it's where we do all of our VR and AR stuff. And we have been working primarily with HoloLens, a few projects with the Vive and the Rift, but primarily HoloLens, and we've been building a lot of holograms, and it's exciting.
Have you named any of them Synergy?
No, not yet. And obviously I can't talk about everything, but just seeing the kind of work that's getting done, the kind of innovation that's happening, like, we are working with entire industries where the way that they do things is suddenly optimized in terms of weeks of time saved just by being able to visualize something in real space through the HoloLens. And this is something that can be done for practically every business. Like, just think about every business where you have to look at analytical data or something that ties to a real world object or building or place. And then imagine that you could just see it floating in the air or overlaid on top of something. Think about how much time that would save.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, architects would
yes,
have a
exactly.
field day with that.
Right? Like, imagine standing at a building site and being able to visualize what the building's going to look like.
That would be a game changer.
Or if you're in, like, real estate, for example, or interior decorating, go into an empty house or an empty apartment that you're trying to sell, you give somebody a HoloLens, whatever the final consumer version of it ends up looking like. I'm going to assume that Microsoft is working as hard as they can to try and pare it down to, like, glasses, basically. I think that's the end game here. So you just hand the people coming to view the house HoloLens glasses.
Yeah.
And you're walking them through the house and it's showing you, like, oh, well, we could give you this fridge or that fridge.
And
or
someone, with their hands, they're, like, dragging things from the interface onto the screen into the virtual environment. Take a couch, put it over here. Take a TV, put it over there.
Exactly. So, I mean, think about IKEA. Like, holy shit. If you could just open an IKEA HoloLens app and just view your house and be like, huh, I wonder if that Billy bookcase will fit here. Oh, it will. Cool.
Oh,
I'll just buy one right now.
No, huge potential for businesses too. You know, actually, that just got me thinking, you know, with the Microsoft Surface computer all in one thing.
Mm-hmm.
how, do you remember how on the video they demoed the little color palette for artists?
With the surface dial? Yeah. Yeah.
I was just thinking of something like that, like, but in a heads-up display virtual reality thing. Like, no, I think this couch should be green. And you just, the color wheel pops up and you're just like, with your fingers pointing to the color that you want and instantly changes. That'd be really awesome.
Yeah, exactly. Like, there's just limitless potential there because, like, virtual reality is cool and all because you can do whatever you want. You can visualize anything you want. But counterintuitively, it's almost like it's kind of a paradoxical thing because it's like you have this infinite space in which to place anything you want, right? It's like that scene in The Matrix where they're in that completely white space and he's like, we need guns, lots of guns. It's like that, and you can fill it with whatever you want, but then it's like, what do you do with that exactly? Like, it's almost too much. Whereas with AR, you're working with stuff that already exists and you're going, okay, so how can we make this faster? How can we make this better? How can we make this easier for people?
Well, that's why they call it augmented reality. You're augmenting stuff onto an existing real world.
Exactly.
Right.
And so you end up with these instantaneous optimizations and innovations and improvements just by saying, okay, we have this thing, now let's put magic holograms all over it. Like, that enables so much.
I'm just thinking, like, it's kind of blowing my mind right now, just how much that'll change the world when that becomes ubiquitous.
Yeah.
Especially for business applications.
Oh, yeah. And the potential for collaboration as well, because
and money saving too.
Yeah. Like, instead of everyone crowding around a screen, you can just give everyone these glasses and be like, here, check out my presentation. And instead of like following along with stupid slides or a PowerPoint presentation, like, imagine what a HoloLens version of PowerPoint would look like. You're showing like real virtual models of things. You're showing like actual landscapes and data. Like, I mean, we always...
Johnny Ive's ideal VR is just a white room.
Yeah.
With nothing in it.
Yeah, featureless white room with every Apple product ever created.
With no smudges.
Yes.
But, and no cables.
But
you don't see them.
Like, it... Like, VR is very immersive, but AR is very collaborative, I think. Like, in VR... Sure, you could theoretically have like an avatar chat sort of thing, but it's not quite the same as being able to interact with real people and share virtual data.
Well, it's more the thing about VR creating entire new worlds that don't exist is entertaining and fun, and it's great for escapism.
Yeah.
But augmented reality is so much more practical on a regular basis because it's something you get actual like beneficial use from every single day in real situations. It's not like on Star Trek, there's the holodeck, but it's like you have to go to this place to get this experience. Whereas augmented reality, if it's built into your contact lenses at some point in the future, it's like, well, anywhere I go, I'm getting a benefit.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, detractors will say, yeah, there's obviously potential for abuse there with ads and things. They can just put giant billboards in your face. Sure.
But you know what?
That can happen.
Any radical new technology, that's where policymakers have to come in. You know, I imagine there will be policies that will have to be created. Mm-hmm. There will be committees that will be created to clamp down on stuff like that. Just like the CRTC was invented to control television and radio broadcasts.
Well, and that's assuming there's some sort of universal overlay that everybody sees.
Yes, right.
That might not be the case. The thing is, you could basically customize your view of the world on the fly. Like...
See, well, that all depends. Yeah, whether or not imagine, we go down the free market approach, or is it, or do we regulate VR? And if so, what does that look like?
Yeah, like these are questions that are going to have to be answered over the next 10 to 20 years as this technology becomes more robust and more refined and more accessible to the average person. But off the top of my head, like imagine an AR version of an ad blocking software that literally blocks real ads. Imagine walking through a city and billboards are basically gray squares, and or you could do like a They Live mode where it makes everything monochrome and all the ads are replaced with consume, reproduce.
That'll probably happen. Unless it's regulated and they say, well, you can't do that because these businesses pay money for this and it needs to be seen or something.
Yeah, but then, of course, you run into the fine line of, well, isn't that free speech by having this presentation of ideas?
True.
Right? And yeah, like these are very real questions that are going to have to be answered because
well, it could become problematic because if everybody just blocks ads and never sees them, then that destroys an entire industry.
Yeah.
You know,
but the thing is, how do you stop that? Like this is computing, right? You'd have to lock all of it down completely. You'd have to completely make it a walled garden and basically say, no, you can't do any software where it completely blocks out physical advertising or something. That'd be the only way you could do it. But the thing is, the tech is democratized, right? Like, sure, there could be Apple glasses and Google glasses and Microsoft glasses, and they could all say, oh, you can only put things on the glasses that are in our app stores and will only allow X, Y, and Z, but there will be open source ones as well because the tech will become, like by that point, the tech will have been developed so much that a lot of companies will be able to get in on it. Because once that initial R&D is done with, you're going to have all these factories in China that just churn out AR chips and AR optical stuff, and you'll be able to get bargain basement generic components and put together your own headset easily.
It probably won't go this way, but I kind of would prefer if the entire industry worked towards creating like a single open sourced API that like everybody buys into this one standard of doing it, because there are benefits to that too, that you don't have this walled garden.
I don't,
and that things
think
can
that
be more controlled that way.
Yeah, I don't think that'll end up happening.
It could though.
It could.
Like it could if VR becomes like this universal thing that like every you know, man, woman, and child has these contact lenses in. And actually, this is very relevant to something that I recently watched. Have you seen that episode of Black Mirror called White Christmas?
Oh, yeah.
So I can see a future like that. And that kind of stuff would have to be regulated to me. Because to create a standard, like in that episode where if, you know, for example, like if you're a sex offender and suddenly using that episode as an example, if you're a sex offender and suddenly you go on a universal blocked list and everybody with those lenses now just sees you as some pixelated, you know, body, they'll know that you're a criminal. Right? But like to have that kind of control, like the government would need some kind of, like you would have government oversight, but there would need to be some, you can't have all these little walled gardens. Like Apple can't have their own standard. Google can't have their own standard, because then the government wouldn't be able to control stuff like that.
Well, I mean, then it's like, would you want them to be able to control that stuff? I don't think you would, because then
but there might be a need for it at some point, right? If we fundamentally change the way we work with and interact with computers. Like this stuff, like right here, I'm looking in front of me like a desktop computer. That could it potentially in 10 years be completely obsolete. There could be no need. Like at some point, there will be no need for that stuff.
The paradigm of it will probably be retained. Like with AR, you can have like a floating desktop screen at your desk and a virtual keyboard and trackpad or whatever, and you're just literally dragging your fingers on nothing, but...
But the idea of using stuff with like a mouse is so old that at some point I just see like, you know, VR contact lenses. You know, that's just like how we interact with, like, you know...
I mean, on a long enough timeline, sure, maybe.
It could just project like on any surface, you know, with augmented reality, you project a keyboard on your desk and suddenly you're typing stuff.
Exactly. And... Like that'll save a lot of money. It'll probably destroy a lot of the computer hardware industry, but yeah,
but it'll create like, new industries, new business.
Yes,
but that's how innovation works, right? That's how disruption works.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, yeah, because with proper miniaturized, fully accessible AR, you can just have infinite screens floating at your desk and have this keyboard that's configured exactly how you want it and a giant trackpad or a virtual mouse or whatever you want. Or you just interact with the screens directly, tilt them down, use a stylus on them, whatever you want to do. And then it's like, well, you don't really need computer hardware anymore, or at least not peripherals. I mean, you'll probably still need the tower, but if you have the headset wirelessly connected to it, then suddenly it's like, yeah, you can have whatever you want running at the same time. It's going to be interesting. It's probably one of the biggest changes to computing in a long time.
And it's rapidly developing, unlike what we've had in the past with this technology, where there were long, long periods of decades, actually, where nothing happened with VR. Almost nothing. But now it's like everything that's happening year over year, we're seeing like major dramatic improvements in the experience, in the performance, and just all across the board.
Yeah. There's a lot of cool stuff happening. CES had a bunch of VR and AR stuff. Different companies other than Google and Microsoft.
Anybody else that we haven't talked about getting into it?
There was this one company working on an AR headset, and this is what got me thinking about it. There's this smaller, more compact than the HoloLens. I don't know if it works as well or not, but it seems more comfortable, less bulky. I mean, the HoloLens isn't particularly bulky, but obviously there's room for improvement.
And Microsoft will buy them in the next year, so wouldn't surprise me.
Who knows? And in an article on The Verge about it, there was a line that caught my eye, and it was that they were saying within a year they could theoretically make it even smaller by offloading a lot of the stuff to a phone or to the computer.
Well, I think for now and probably the next few years, we'll probably have to do that just for practicality's sake. If you want to keep those wearables small, you can't shove a lot of that hardware in there because batteries, you got to have batteries.
Well, and then the other issue is you need enough wireless bandwidth to be able to do that. Though this year we've got Bluetooth 5, which is going to have low latency, high bandwidth connectivity as part of the spec. So Bluetooth 5 has increased range and increased speed, but then past that, you can actually choose to optimize it for further increased bandwidth or further increased range. So you could have a high bandwidth Bluetooth 5 connection to something. That's a possible route. They could also go for Y-Gig, which is an extremely high bandwidth Wi-Fi direct line of sight connection that enables gigabit speed. So that's another possible alternative. In fact, I would bet that the next iteration of Oculus Rift and HTC Vive use YGig to make their headsets wireless. So you would just have like a YGig antenna at your desk, and then it would directly connect using beamforming to the headset and establish a gigabit input-output link between the computer and the headset, which would allow it to actually be able to display the VR content without any lag or stutter. So, I mean, either one of those could theoretically allow an AR headset to be extremely thin and just have a tiny little wireless chip in them, and then the phone or the computer does all of the heavy lifting. In fact, I would bet that that's what Apple does when they eventually release something. Although with them, I'm not sure if it's going to be VR or AR. I would think it's going to be AR because Tim Cook has talked a lot more about AR.
He's hinted about it.
Yeah, he's definitely hinted about it. I think he even said something to the effect of he's very bullish on AR compared to VR.
His typical line is always be it AR or whatever their interest, whatever new technologies they're interested in. He basically always says the same things, like Apple's very interested in this whatever area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, we're taking a strong interest, which is wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Yeah, we're working on something.
Well, I mean, Apple works on all kinds of stuff. Whether it turns into an actual product, though, is anyone's guess. But, I mean, at the same time, they'd be extremely foolish not to try and get in on it somehow. I think ultimately they will make some sort of AR device, and my thinking is that it will probably be a pair of glasses, and it'll look like a pair of glasses. Like, it'll basically be fancier Ray-Bans, maybe with some LEDs somewhere, maybe made of aluminum, and they'll have come up with a novel way to get the AR to display perfectly on the lenses without taking up too much space. And then all that'll basically be inside will be terraced batteries that go the length of the frame for maximum battery life.
When you say terraced, you mean in like stacked, layered?
Yes,
batteries?
Layered and shaped to fit the curve of the glasses. It's a technology that they've been toying with for a while. They haven't quite nailed it yet.
Well, didn't they do something like that on the new MacBooks?
They were going to, but it didn't work out. So they ended up having to go with a more traditional battery design, which may be why battery life on the new MacBook Pro is less than stellar, because they were intending to have the new terraced batteries, but ended up having to go with plan B. Once they finally figured that out, that'll probably go in there. And then they'll have some upgraded version of the W1 chip that has Bluetooth 5 or possibly YGig. I don't know. Whatever ends up being better.
Has the Bluetooth 5 standard been, like, is that...
Yes.
Finalized.
Yes.
That's done.
It's locked in.
We're going to start seeing products soon.
Start seeing products soon. Qualcomm, I think, actually announced a Bluetooth 5 chip.
I wonder if it's too late for Apple to build that into the next iPhone for September. I imagine the design must be finalized by now, or getting there.
Yeah. It
probably doesn't go into production until July or whatever.
The thing is, Apple's been part of the working group. Like, all the major tech companies are part of the Bluetooth SIG.
Of course.
So they're aware of the spec far in advance. I mean, the Bluetooth 5 spec was started years ago. It's finalized now, as in all deliberation on this has been done. It's locked in. Chips can be made now. But the thing is, this has been in the works for years. So I can't remember exactly, but I think if you build your Bluetooth radio with certain functionality, it can technically be upgraded to Bluetooth 5, depending on how it's built. Obviously, yeah, that may not be the case for everything. I don't know. I guess we'll find out. But if not this year, definitely next year. I would bet that 2018 we'll see pretty much every Apple device launch with Bluetooth 5. And then the great thing about that is, because of the added bandwidth, Bluetooth will become the superior choice for things like AirPlay and handoff and so on.
Well, AirPlay doesn't currently go over Bluetooth.
No.
It's Wi-Fi.
But with Bluetooth 5, it could.
Right.
Because
you think it would be more reliable over Bluetooth than Wi-Fi?
Well, the...
I mean, where AirPlay is with pretty good over Wi-Fi.
With Apple's wireless chips, like, if they continue to develop the W1, come up with a Bluetooth 5 W2 chip, that would probably be just as good as Wi-Fi. I mean, yeah, obviously this is all theoretical. No Bluetooth 5 anything exists as of yet. So it's hard to say whether or not it would be as good as Wi-Fi. Obviously, Wi-Fi is a more stable connection just because you're bathed in it, right? If you're
right.
Anywhere near a router, it's like, yeah.
Well, all the hundreds devices. Of wireless channels going simultaneously,
yeah.
Which you do not have with Bluetooth.
No. And Bluetooth is on a different wavelength, and it can be easily interfered with by other Bluetooth devices. I mean, a lot of work's been done to mitigate that, but you will still run into interference. Like, even with the W1 chip in the AirPods, right? Like, I can be walking along and it can suddenly crap out for like half a second because something interfered with it. So, I mean, that does still happen regardless. It's a lot better than most things though. So yeah, I mean, it remains to be seen whether Bluetooth 5 will be a dramatic improvement over Bluetooth 4, but we'll see. So back to the glasses. Yeah, some kind of novel way of having a bit high bandwidth signal between the glasses and the phone. The phone will do all the heavy lifting. They'll probably, like, it'll be like the A11 or A12 chip, and it'll have some kind of special coprocessor that specifically handles, like, the rendering pipeline for the glasses. And then it pipes out the rendered frames to the glasses via that high bandwidth connection.
That makes sense.
And
yeah, because you wouldn't want to do all of that stuff, all of those tasks, just on one chip, because that's not efficient. And for battery life reasons, you probably want separate chips handling.
Exactly.
And probably for stability too.
Yeah.
Dedicated bandwidth.
Yeah. Because you still have to run the phone, right? So you wouldn't want the phone running rendering for the glasses and its own stuff at the same time, because that'll make the phone slower and the glasses slower. And building coprocessors is what Apple's specialized in now. So yeah, I mean, it's a natural fit for them to do some kind of pipeline like that.
Sure. And they're obsessed with miniaturization anyway, so I'm sure they'll find some creative way of squeezing in yet another coprocessor in there.
Oh yeah. And
or somehow maybe package two coprocessors like in one package.
Oh yeah.
Together.
I could see them doing like a AR encapsulated chip, kind of like what they have in the watch, where it's like all these different coprocessors in this one little module. I could see them having something like that in the glasses, where it's like, okay, we've got the high bandwidth connectivity, we've got this little rendering chip for the visual stuff.
Yeah.
Maybe an accelerometer for head tracking, that kind of thing, and then bundle that all together. I guess optimistically we could see that product in 2018, but probably closer to 2020, I would think, just because the miniaturization isn't quite there yet. I mean, the HoloLens is effectively state-of-the-art, and even that is quite big, and the field of view on it isn't complete to your periphery.
Yeah, I agree. I think we're at least three years away from something like that.
Yeah. But, I mean, with the HoloLens, they have an entire Windows PC in there, right? They're not doing some sort of wireless connection to a computer. All of the processing that happens directly on the device, which is part of why it's so big. So the thing is, if Apple were to offload all of that onto the phone, the actual device itself could be a lot smaller. So taking that approach, I think, yeah.
Like, I mean, if they can't do that, at least maybe have some of it processed on the device and or on the headset, then some of it, you know, the other half or the bulk of it processed on the phone.
Yeah, and I think they learned a lot with the watch launch, because the first version of watchOS, infamously, all of the apps ran on the phone and streamed to the watch. But the only problem with that was the Bluetooth connection was way too slow. So everything took like 30 seconds to load. That, of course, was before watchOS 2, when they allowed native apps to run on the watch. So they'll have to not do that this time around. So whatever technology they end up going with for that connectivity, it's going to have to be much faster so that that issue doesn't happen. Though, on the other hand, you're probably not going to have traditional apps per se on the glasses, because really the glasses are just displaying things. It's really the phone that would drive all of that stuff. Unless they build like a whole gestural control system. I mean, they have a ton of patents on this stuff. They have the company that invented the Kinect. They bought them. They've had them sitting in Israel for years now, doing who knows what. So, I mean, they have access to a lot of R&D and tech around this stuff. And, yeah, I mean, at this point, it's pretty murky. So, who knows?
You've been listening to The Impromptu on Hologram Radio. I'm Alex Knight, joined by Michael Norton, as always. We'd appreciate if you could show your support for this podcast and the work that we do here by becoming a regular sustaining donator. Donate a dollar every month via Patreon. You can do that today by going to patreon.com/hologramradio. It really does make a difference. Subscribe to the show in iTunes to ensure you get every new episode each and every week, or your favorite podcast player of choice, wherever you can find podcasts. We should be there. We're on TuneIn and Stitcher and now Google Play as well. And we'd appreciate a review wherever you can leave it, because it makes us feel good and it also helps other people discover the podcast. You can follow us on Twitter. We're at The Impromptu. Michael Norton is at Zen Impulse. I'm at Zero Distraction. You can find us on Facebook as well if you just search for Hologram Radio. And you can send us email the old fashioned. You can send us email the old-fashioned way if you'd like to send us some feedback. That email goes to the both of us. It is theimpromptu@hologramradio.org.
And on that note, thanks for listening, everyone. See you next time.